This is Functional Medicine Update for February 1998, Volume 17, Number 2. Our subject for this month will be on the diseases of gene expression. This month's tape will feature extensive reports on genetics and human health, including aging and cancer, nutrients as gene modulators, testing and interpreting molecular reactions, and the genetic factors of breast cancer. Our interview will be with pioneering cancer researcher Dr. Stanislaw Berzinski. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the February 1998 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
You know, we've got this upcoming 5th International Symposium on Functional Medicine to be held at the Orchid Resort on the Moanalani side of Island of Hawaii, May 2nd through 7th, 1998. And the title of that is Functional Medicine Applications to Disorders of Gene Expression. I hope that you're all able to attend and be part of that, what I think will be an extraordinary meeting, both clinically, professionally, and in vision tending. But it also, because it's such a new topic, causes us to pause and ask, why is it that we have focused this 5th International Conference on functional medicine applications of disorders of gene expression? And it is our collective belief at HealthCom International that the action point of the emerging medicine in the new millennium will be on gene regulators and modification of gene expression as it relates to things that we do to the genes. Lifestyle, thoughts, attitudes, beliefs, environments, diet, relationships, energy, all of these are modulators of gene expression. And therefore, the uncovering of improving health, reducing disease, and even treating certain diseases will be locked into our better understanding of what the gene messages are, how to uncover the right gene messages and to put to sleep the wrong gene messages, and lead to a phenotype that, in fact, exhibits high-level health for the 8, 9, or 10 decades or more of life. Well, that is the reason that we have titled the 5th International Symposium on Functional Medicine as Applications to Disorders of Gene Expression, with specific emphasis on homocysteine and inflammation and nutrient modulation of adverse drug side effects through the impact of nutrients on gene expression and detoxification, and on the nutrient modulation of cancer genes. And it's that third topic that I think we want to spend some time this month in the February issue of Functional Medicine Update talking about, because it is a very good entry point or a way of getting into the theory and application of nutrient modulation of gene expression that can open up the door for a whole new paradigm shift, if I can once again steal from Dr. Thomas Kuhn the concept of a paradigm shift. As you know, we are moving into a time of genomic medicine in which the remarkable diversity of the human genes are starting to be seen through the Human Genome Project, the sequencing of the genetic structure occurring in laboratories around the world. Dr. Lewis Thomas, one of the great chroniclers of the evolution of medicine in the 20th century, was quoted as saying, "The uniformity of Earth's life, more astounding than its diversity, is accountable by the high probability that we derived originally from some single cell fertilized in a bolt of lightning as the Earth cooled, and ever since, diversity has started to develop." Well, we can imagine in the next period of time, actually in a short period of time, the field of genetic evaluation, genetic counseling, preventive and prospective medicine, nutrition and lifestyle management, and the pharmacology of today will all converge into a single new type of medicine in which the doctor, the patient, the nurse, and other health paraprofessionals who are skilled in understanding specific types of nutrient gene or lifestyle gene or energy gene or structure gene interactions will be a part of a team collaborating on the development of a treatment program for a patient to improve the expression of their phenotype from the polymorphic genotypes that are existing. It's a very interesting concept, and it's actually described in an article that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 278, page 1212 in 1997, talking about genomic medicine. And by the way, I might urge you, if you've not gone to the World Wide Web and seen what's happening in the area of the Human Genome Project applied to medicine, that you go to a website that is worldwideweb.hhmi.org/genetic trail, that's capital G-E-N-E-T-I-C, capital T-R-A-I-L, /, And if you take a look at that website, you will see a study program, a self-study program on human genetics, human genome project, and the relationship to gene-specific risk diseases. It's a very interesting example of where we're going in making this information more available, not only to health practitioners and professionals, but also to patients as well. Let's specifically talk then about the modulation of cancer genes for the sake of this month's issue to try to use a specific example for a more general theme that we'll be discussing at the 5th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. Some of you may be thinking at this point, well, this is a very interesting theoretic discussion we're going to have for the next 90 minutes together and has very little clinical relevancy to the way that I think about or practice medicine today. What Jeff Bland is doing is just helping guide me to think about where we might be in the future. And I really don't have enough time to be too worried about where we're in the future because I'm having enough challenge being in the present and doing a good job. Well, I need to tell you that if you'll stay tuned and attentive for the next 90 minutes, I think you'll see that there is an immediate payoff from the application of what we know today about modulation of gene expression, and that can open up new opportunities for improved patient outcome and lowered problems related to chronic degenerative disease. So with that as an introduction, let me talk about a review paper that appeared in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 89, page 1489, entitled Aging and Cancer, Issues of Basic and Clinical Science. And in this article, they talk about what are the theories of aging and how do these relate to the evidence that people tend to get more cancer as they grow older. And they talked about the fact that it's probable that certain critical genes in humans relate to aging and lifespan. We know now that genetic regulation of disease, that we're getting clues about the regulation that are coming from the Human Genome Project. We've identified a whole series of very severe cases of aging that are related to gene uniqueness, like progeria or Werner syndrome or Down syndrome. These are the outliers, however, on the continuum of gene alteration or gene mutations or gene uniquenesses related to aging, obviously representing precocious aging at the accelerated type where a Werner syndrome child may undergo what appears to be the whole of the aging process in 15 years and die as an old-looking individual in their mid-teenage years. We know that there are certain genes that are tied to this, and they're related to oxidative stress-type reactions and inflammation reactions that encode for increased exposure to oxidants like superoxide hydroxyl radical, seeming to result then in increased cellular damage in lipofuscin pigment formation and ceroid pigment deposition and amyloid deposition in various organs that choke off those organs from their function and cause them to undergo apoptotic cell death and more rapid biological aging. There are within our genes various sections in the genes, or what are called telomeres, that actually seem to guide genes and influence how they're expressed and how they relate to the aging process. Like telomere length, there are factors that non-specifically influence gene or protein function that accumulate over time damage, including not only the reactive oxygen species, ionizing radiation, drug and chemical-induced damage, even stress can be toxic when administered by a high stress lifestyles over chronic periods of time. In so doing, increase then cellular damage and the deposition of these secondary debris of cellular apoptotic function. Apoptosis, as you know, is a process by which cells undergo death, not by necrosis, but rather by the change of the cytoskeletal structure, the thing that holds the cell in its three-dimensional shape. It tends to shrink like a puppet whose strings are pulled in until it kind of pinches itself off, micropinocytosis almost, and in so doing, the cell ultimately loses its function. And this may occur as a consequence of the deposition of amyloid protein, or it may occur as a consequence of glycation reactions that occur to proteins, or it may occur as a consequence of oxidative stress, free radical-induced damage to proteins, nucleic acids, and membrane lipids. All of these are tied back then to gene uniquenesses and to how that gene is expressed or how those genes are expressed through an individual's lifestyle selection and environmental selections. That then contributes to cellular senescence, which then contributes to overall change in genetic messaging and what we call the outcome of that person's life, the health of their organs and organ systems. How does that relate to aging and cancer? Well, we recognize that these accumulative damages that occur to cells as a consequence of these processes ultimately can have their influence then on the regulation of certain genes that may encode for the cellular architecture and cellular state, either juvenile states, embryonic states, dedifferentiated clonal states that we call tumors, or it could encode for more differentiated states and resistance factors and higher immunochemical defense that are related to younger biological age individuals. As individuals get older, the damage that has been sustained to DNA and mutagenic damage and carcinogenic damage that results from hits that may have occurred at tumor promoter regions on the gene or have influenced then the cell signals that increase the probability of a message that was put to sleep now being awakened or a message that was awakened being put to sleep, these factors ultimately then can lead to an oncogenic event in which a cell is transformed to this dedifferentiated clonal juvenile type of embryonic cell, which then starts to develop the personality of a cell that ultimately, as a group of cells in a tissue, can ultimately break off and metastasize, become invasive, have the personalities of a tumor. And there are many processes that we're now identifying that are related to this genetic event that is associated with the dedifferentiation of a cell that becomes then a juvenile-like cell, an embryonic cell that has these characteristics that we associated with ultimately the proliferation and becoming a palpable or diagnosable cancer. This article discussing this talks about the fact that the events become more probable as we grow older in age, our chronological age, because we have had more opportunity for events to occur within our genome that might increase the probability of expression of these altered messages, the signals that relate to cell replication and cell differentiation. However, it doesn't mean that chronological age in and of itself necessarily codes for cancer. What it really suggests is that the events then that may result in the message of a cell going from normal to tumor-like state are more probable to occur at an older age and therefore require ever more significant vigilance to know who is at greater risk, what are the genes that person carries that might dispose them to these events, and what can be done to modify gene expression. And that is, of course, the basis of this article in Molecular Medicine Today, in which the discussion is on how cancer gene testing can benefit patients as we learn more about the P53 or the P21 oncogenes or the RAS oncogenes or the breast cancer BRCA genes and how they then encode for specific potential of risk that individual might have if exposed to certain things in their lifestyle or their environment that could trigger then the expression of these messages. And we're learning that some of these gene messages are inducible and some are not inducible. The constitutive ones, obviously, are ones that do not have as much ability to be modified, whereas the inducible factors, which appear to be a whole range of the now newly identified heredity cancer genes, these inducible factors can be modified by environment, lifestyle, and factors that might be considered reducible risk factors. And it's that molecular basis of cancer prevention that is now starting to really capture the attention of the scientific community, taking the genetic risk factors and tying it to their inducibility or suppression factors, looking at how that regulates or normalizes cell differentiation and cell function. P53 obviously is one of these protein factors that's been identified as a cancer gene component, protein 53. People are now starting to identify ways of targeting these specific gene factors as it relates to how they can be put to sleep or woken up in immunotherapy or in cancer therapy. This is the biological basis of cancer therapy as contrasted to killing all cells that have undergone a specific transformation and the traditional oncogenic kind of Sherman's March to the Sea approach of make sure that you get enough cytotoxic agent in the body to kill every cell that's undergone a change of this type. And in so doing, also pay the risk, obviously, of killing some of the normal cells that have similar mitotic and physiological function. This other biological approach to cancer is trying to identify those specific areas in the body where certain gene regulators have been upregulated or downregulated associated with cancer and then direct the attention of the immune system specifically to those to turn off or turn on those messages and renormalize cellular function. Well, we know that there are a whole variety of newly identified cancer genes, as they're called, or genes that encode for risk, not just the P21, P53, RAS, and BRCA, but also a series of genes that relate to both the constitutive and to the modifiable, inducible detoxification enzymes, the cytochrome P450s and the phase 2 detoxifying enzymes that are, again, encoded for specific regions of our genes. Genetic polymorphisms, for instance, of cytochrome P450 2D6. And remember, there are a whole variety of isoforms of these cytochrome P450 gene products. There are probably over 100 different isoforms in the human that encode for detoxification efficiency of specific classes of substances or chemicals. So you might have gene characteristics that are adequate for one family of detoxification, but you might have inactivity or underactivity for another. A very specific genetic link to susceptibility factors to specific toxic substances, be it either endotoxins or exotoxins. The cytochrome P450 2D6 polymorphisms are interesting because, as you probably know, this is the isoform of cytochrome P450 that's responsible for detoxifying many drugs, including the Prozac-like compounds. Therefore, individuals that have altered detoxification as controlled by their genes by cytochrome P450 2D6 may have then differing toxicity reactions associated with these kinds of substances that pass through that principal pathway on their way to being detoxified. And in a recent paper in Carcinogenesis, Volume 18, page 1203, 1997, in this paper, which looked at the ethnicity and the relationships to cytochrome P450 2D6 and lung cancer risk in African Americans and Caucasians in Los Angeles County, did not find that ethnicity was the principal controller of risk factor relative to cytochrome P450 D6, but rather it appeared to be ranges of difference in the activity of those detoxification enzymes across ethnicity. So it's not so much tied to one specific ethnic type as it is tied to the variation of the expression of these genes over different types of genetic backgrounds. The same thing holds true in the detoxification of hormones, both female estrogen-like hormones and male testosterone-like hormones. These are also detoxified by cytochrome P450s, which have differing genetic linkages to their detoxification ability. Recently, again, the liver detoxification of hormones, in this case estrogen-like hormones, by cytochrome P450 1A2 and 3A4 was evaluated. And 1A2 is an interesting one because it's an inducible detoxification enzyme where diet and other variables can influence its upregulation or downregulation. And here, again, it's found that there's very significant difference in how estrogen hormones are detoxified in individuals based upon their genetic characteristics of cytochrome P450 1A2 expression and 3A4. And by modifying the environment and nutrition, you can thereby induce or suppress the activity of detoxification of hormones. This sounds a lot like what Dr. Carlton Fredericks talked about some 30 years ago when he was discussing diet and breast cancer in women. He was talking about the liver's connection to the breast through the detoxification of hormones. In the last 30 years, we have seen an incredible increase in our understanding of the genetic relationships to detoxification and the nutrient modulation thereof of the expression of these genes and the activity of these detox enzymes. But I certainly want to attribute to Dr. Fredericks a very important first-level vision as to how detoxification of hormones and the liver relationship to this could play a role in increasing risk to various female-related cancers. By the same token, we see a whole range of reports in the literature talking about the genes that encode for the expression of the phase 2 detoxification enzymes, like glutathione S-transferase or N-acetyl transferase or glucuronidation. We know that individuals that have poor expression of glutathione S-transferase, the M1 isoform, and who smoke have a much higher risk to emphysema and lung cancer than individuals who do not carry this genetic characteristic. And therefore, once again, environment tied to genetic uniqueness can give rise to the expression of a phenotype of disease. Conversely, the right environment tied to a phenotype which might have risk but not expressed may lead to the prevention of disease. So we're starting to see this model emerge that Dr. Roger Williams talked about in the terms of biochemical individuality and genetic individuality now being expressed through this molecular model of medicine into designing an appropriate nutrition, lifestyle, and environment for the individual that matches their genotype to express in a phenotype of lower risk. We see many, many papers that are starting to appear in the literature each week on this, indicating the rapidity by which this field is advancing. The Lancet, just the last few issues, volume 350, page 630 in 1997, association between polymorphism and genes and epoxide hydrolase, another detoxification enzyme, and the susceptibility to emphysema, showing that genetic polymorphisms in xenobiotic detoxifying enzymes has a role in individual susceptibility to oxalate-related lung disease, because the lung mucosa also has its own detoxification system, just as does the gastrointestinal lumen have its own phase 1 and phase 2 detoxification system. So individuals who have genetically sluggish or slow detoxification systems are then at much higher risk to cellular damage by the exposure to certain xenobiotics, and therefore increasing our vigilance about environmental controls and nutrition to try to support proper detoxification pathways in these genetically susceptible individuals becomes a focus for prognostic medicine or functional medicine. We recognize the same thing in lung cancer risk with poor expression of glutathione S-transferase M1 isoform in looking at Mediterraneans. This is again a paper in Carcinogenesis, volume 18, page 1529. And in this case, you would say, okay, if you had a sluggish glutathione S-transferase enzyme, how do you activate that pathway? And clearly, by mass action, Le Chatelier's principle, we try to then force that sluggish equilibrium to completion by administering more of the conjugating nutrient, in this case, N-acetylcysteine as a glutathione stimulant or glutathione itself, to try to enhance then the phase 2 glutathione conjugation reactions, which may be inactive. All of this relates back to signals that are present within cells and tissues that encode for the expression of certain genes. Signals we often think of as a radio signal, as an electromagnetic radiation that's coming from a transmitter to a receiver and creating then out of a speaker a sound. You can use that same metaphor to think of signals within cells, where one cell is communicating with another as a consequence of the release of electrochemical messages. These can be either occurring through the nervous system or, more likely, through chemoreception pathways of either small or large molecules that react with certain membrane binding sites or transmembrane effectors, which then influence ultimately nuclear and mitochondrial DNA expression, and in so doing then can reset the thermostat, so to speak, of the cell into a new physiological state. And we're starting to learn that chemicals and environmental agents and stress and nutrients are such modifiers of signal transduction and gene expression. Recently, in a very interesting review paper in the Advances in Enzyme Regulation, volume 37, page 35, the article entitled Regulation of Signal Transduction Program by Drugs looked at this whole field that's emerging and how it's targeting or focusing drug design to try to reset proper cell signals and cell messages in intracellular communication, and then the downstream molecules that result from that come off of expressed genes then create an environment within the cell that leads to normal or more improved cellular function. This is obviously heading us on toward a new view of cancer therapy, trying to find what these altered cell transduction agents are, modify signals to express genes and put to sleep certain genes like RAS and wake up other genes that might be related to normal cellular architecture. And many drug companies are now actively involved in trying to explore what molecules can reset these signals and induce the appropriate signals across the cellular membranes and to the nucleus of cells to encourage proper gene expression. What we're seeing through this research is that there are a number of nutrients that have been identified as gene expression agents. Certainly the flavonoid family, of which there are over 1,000 identified food flavonoids, are being identified as a family which have gene response effects, differing flavonoids having differing influences on gene expression. We know that trace minerals are being found to have influence on gene expression, including selenium, which has been in the news considerably lately. As you know from the paper that we reviewed in Functional Medicine Update a few months ago that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association on selenium supplementation 200 micrograms per day and cancer incidence, it was suggested that selenium had a cancer protective effect. Well, the role that selenium plays appears to be not just by modulating glutathione peroxidase at the post-transcriptional translational level, but also on its influence on gene expression and cellular redox, this whole influence then on the reduction oxidation within cells and how that sets up then differing messages that pertain to signal transduction. We know that individuals that live in areas of low soil selenium have higher percentage incidence of cancer than individuals who live in areas of high soil selenium. There is ever-increasing evidence to indicate that selenium and its influence on cellular function is greater than that one can measure solely by measuring glutathione peroxidase activities, which is a selenium-containing metalloenzyme that's involved with antioxidation and the quenching of superoxide anion radical. We recognize that selenium plays a role in a deiodinization of T4 to thyroxine, and therefore there is an increased regulation of endocrine function in cell signals through thyroid hormone metabolism. And as a consequence of selenium's role in other redox processes, it may influence things like nuclear factor kappa B and other types of cell signal transduction downstream modulators that influence then replication of cells and apoptotic cell damage. So minerals, obviously, also are on the list of nutrients that can modulate gene expression. Also vitamins. We're starting to see much more being published about various vitamins, not only the methyl donor-controlling nutrients like folate, B12, B6, and betaine, but also other members of the antioxidant and fat-soluble vitamin family, including vitamin E and vitamin A, and of course, vitamin C. Dr. Susan Preston-Martin, who is the University of Southern California Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center in Los Angeles, has reported that pregnant women who take vitamin supplements, including vitamin C, A, vitamin E, and folate throughout pregnancy, were half as likely to have a child who developed a brain tumor before age 5 compared with women who took no vitamins. So it's not just anencephaly and spina bifida, but there may be a whole range of other fetal development abnormalities that occur through faulty gene expression in utero development that are avoided with proper nutrient enrichment of the amniotic fluid and the embryo, the fetus. So again, we're talking about throughout the whole course of one's life, from conception throughout all the aging processes, these nutrients may play a role in modulating gene expression. I don't want to focus just on micronutrients because certainly macronutrients also play a role in modulating gene expression as well, like the peroxisome proliferators and the relationship that has to high saturated fat diet, which may be one of the associations with atherosclerotic risk with high saturated fat intake due to increased oxidative stress. We also recognize that in colon cancer that high fat diets influence the gene expression regulation of various oncogenes in the colonic environment, which increases colon cancer risk, and that if you put that animal on a low-fat diet, it turns off those messages and reduces the risk. A very interesting paper coming out of George Washington University School of Medicine, Dr. Oliver Alabaster's laboratory in collaboration with the Central Institute of Cancer Research in Japan, in which they showed suppression of intestinal polyp development, which is a precursor marker for colon cancer, by a low-fat diet and high fiber, indicating that there was an influence on gene expression in these animals by what the genes in the colonic mucosa were bathed with as a consequence of its intestinal contents, and that high-fiber, low-fat diets created a message, if I can use that term advisedly, a message to the genes of the colonic cell that put them at rest. So we can see that this field is rapidly advancing with exploding information that has clinical implication. Let's take this now from the kind of general theme to the specifics, and let's look at breast cancer first as an example of how environment and nutrition can modulate genes that may encode for risk to breast cancer. And I'm here talking about the BRCA genes that have been identified recently that encode for breast cancer risk. Let's first talk about breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy, because here is a substance that obeys the genes with experience, in this case its hormones, and could influence then gene expression and expression of relative risk. A very interesting review paper was published in The Lancet, maybe many of you saw it, volume 350, page 1047 in 1997, which was the result of the Collaborative Group on Hormonal Factors in Breast Cancer, in which they were reviewing breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy. This was a reanalysis of data from 51 epidemiological studies of 52,705 women with breast cancer and 108,411 women without breast cancer. the methods that they used were very good epidemiological statistical methods, making sure that the median age of the group studied were comparable. They looked at HRT use starting at about median age of 48 and started to look at the influence it had statistically throughout these large epidemiological studies and meta-analysis on breast cancer incidence. The interpretation of the findings was that the risk of having breast cancer diagnosis increased in women who use HRT and increases with increasing duration of use. The effect is reduced after cessation of use of the hormone replacement therapy and has largely, if not wholly, disappeared within about 5 years. They suggest that these findings should be considered in the context of the benefits and other risks associated with the use of HRT, and the shorter the duration of use and the lower the dose that is used, obviously the risk factor is also reduced. So here again we talk about an exogenous factor, hormone replacement therapy, having influence on the gene expression, in particularly in women who may be at higher genetic risk, that carry that genetic uniqueness, and that modulating the duration of use and the amount of hormones that are replaced can have an influence on the expression of risk. Again, we talk also about the connection to the liver and detoxification of these hormones, an appropriate linkage between the BRCA breast cancer and the liver detoxification factors. Recall, if you would, the paper that we cited from the Journal of the American Medical Association a few months ago, in which it was found in smoking women who had breast cancer, they carried with them a genetic risk for poor detoxification through a slow acetylation pattern. And so if you couple together a BRCA breast cancer risk gene with a poor detoxification gene, and then you expose that woman to estrogens and cigarette smoke and alcohol, you start weighting the factors very, very heavily to increasing expression of the cellular architecture as ultimately a cancer cell. So taking this, what can we derive out of the breast cancer and hormone replacement argument? Obviously, it's a very highly controversial area with a lot of different opinions being expressed from different individuals, and I would have to say not a clear consensus that one can come out with the comfort saying, well, all people certainly agree with this as the logical position. I think the best way of summarizing it is the very nice comments made by Andrea LaCroix and Wiley Burke in their review article from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, talking about the epidemiological meta-analysis study and how it should be interpreted. They say these are exciting times for women's health in the prevention arena. Healthcare providers, researchers, and the pharmaceutical industry share the hope that someday there will be agents that can help prevent the major chronic conditions that cause disability and death in older women, namely fractures, heart attacks, and women's cancers, including breast cancer. There is a danger that new preventive agents marketed as alternatives to hormone replacement, like selective estrogen receptor modulators or biophosphonates, and there's a whole class of compounds, as you know, that are now coming out to be alternatives to HRT, will be assumed to be effective and safer when in fact there is no information on their long-term risks and benefits. Hormone replacement therapy has been and continues to be the focus of well-designed studies, both observational and experimental, but it should not be held to a higher standard of evidence than any of the newer agents marketed as alternatives to hormone replacement. Physicians have an ethical obligation to inform women that we do not yet know about the newer agents, which could ultimately be found to harm them. And therefore, we come back to, rather than pharmacology, what's the first step on a treatment or a management program of women's hormones? And it's to try to balance their hormone synthesis and metabolism as naturally as we can and limit the need to the extent possible for HRT. Remember, the adrenal glands can compensate in some capacity for the loss of ovarian estrogen secretion by their own de novo estrogen synthesis, and therefore proper adrenal cortical function, appropriate liver detoxification function, and lowering other risk factors that vie for the activation of proximal carcinogens like alcohol, cigarette smoke, and other xenobiotics, forms itself as a very effective strategy at first level to design and appropriate a program for a woman before you start implementing HRT, or even with HRT, to lower potentially the dose that's required to get benefit. What about the environmental xenobiotics that may also exacerbate or aggravate these problems, like organochlorines, DDT and DDEs? As you know, there's been a long discussion about whether environmental toxins like dioxins as xenoestrogens and organochlorine compounds beyond that of dioxin participate in these types of increased oncogenic risk. a recent paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 337, page 1253, looked at exposure to environmental estrogens such as the organochlorines and pesticides and industrial chemicals and tried to evaluate whether there was an interrelationship between plasma levels of DDE and PCBs prospectively among 240 women who gave blood samples in 1989 and 90 and the relationship to breast cancer. What they concluded is that the data do not seem to support the hypothesis that exposure to a DDT or PCBs increases the risk of breast cancer based upon the sample size. And therefore, there may be many other modulating factors that occur. Again, when we start doing statistical averages in these studies, we have to be somewhat cautious not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there may be specific women with specific genotypes for whom risk is increased upon exposure but get lost in the data when you do averaging. And I think it's this biochemical uniqueness that comes out of the Human Genome Project and how we will start to evaluate these uniquenesses using certain types of functional laboratory tests. The gene evaluations and gene expression evaluations looking at functional capabilities of that individual to respond to those particular types of exposures either safely or unsafely. So where are we in the xenoestrogens and breast cancer area? The editorial that followed this particular paper in the New England Journal of Medicine goes on to say that there have been papers recently that show that there's a high incidence of breast cancer in women that can be accounted for by known risk factors, including parity, age at first-term pregnancy, months of breastfeeding, age at menopause, age at menarche, and alcohol consumption. And it is possible that the confirmed clusters of breast cancer on Long Island and other regions of the Northeast may be explained by known risk factors. There is seemingly, if any, a weak relationship between PCB and DDT and DDE exposure and breast cancer, and therefore it's the combination of these factors together that gives rise to impacting the gene uniqueness of the individual and expressing then altered cell regulatory processes that we call risk of breast cancer. So they go on to say, we shouldn't put all of our emphasis then on xenoestrogens as the cause of the increasing incidence of breast cancer, but we should be looking at a complex of interrelationships between environment and diet, lifestyle, and genes that give rise to the expression. What about phytoestrogens? Because certainly they have been in the news coming from plant-derived substances, particularly soy, as the most well-studied of the phytoestrogen-contributing foods. Many papers have been published recently on phytoestrogens, and to do justice in review of them would take more time certainly than we have available in this month's Functional Medicine Update. But I did want to give you a couple of what I think are insightful reviews and comments about soy or no soy, and when to use soy, and when to use concentrated phytoestrogens as genistein, diazine, as agents either in prevention or potentially in therapy. The Annual Review of Nutrition, Volume 17, page 353 in 1997, had a very nice review article on dietary phytoestrogens. Broadly defined, phytoestrogens include a class of compounds called isoflavones, cumestanes, and lignans. A number of these compounds have been identified in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains that are commonly consumed in the foods by humans. Soybeans, clover, and alfalfa sprouts, and oil seeds such as flaxseed are the most significant dietary sources of isoflavones, cumestans, and lignans, respectively. Flaxseed is far and away the greatest contributor to the diet of lignans, and soy is undoubtedly the greatest contributor to intake of the isoflavones. Isoflavones have the names, like I mentioned, genistein and diazine. Studies in humans, animals, and cell culture systems suggest that these dietary phytoestrogens that include the isoflavones, cumestans, and lignans play an important role in the prevention of menopausal symptoms, potentially osteoporosis by their estrogenic-like effects, cancer, and heart disease. Proposed mechanisms include estrogenic and anti-estrogenic effects, induction of cancer cell differentiation, inhibition of tyrosine kinases and DNA topoisomerase activities that help to regulate gene expression, and suppression of angiogenesis and also their antioxidant effects. So there's a whole range of very positive benefits that appear to accrue to those individuals who consume higher levels of the phytoestrogens found in certain foods, ranging from flax to soy. I think the term phytoestrogens leads to a misnomer because it suggests that men would be ill-advised to consume these foods that contain phytoestrogens. So men might stay away from flax and soy like the plague, thinking that if they do, they're going to be feminized and it's going to produce an adverse effect. I think the term phytoestrogens really should have been altered to phytohormones, because we're really talking about hormone modulators, mediators, effectors that influence receptor site binding of estrogen and testosterone, or cellular regulation effects, or tyrosine kinase effects, or gene expression effects. We're not talking solely about the same effects that if you gave estrogen to an individual, what influence would it have on their cell physiology. So I think the term phytoestrogens are somewhat misleading. We know that the phytoestrogen family mediates its effect on human physiology through a complex relationship between the lignans, the cumestans, and the isoflavones, and the relationship they have to gut microbial activity. This is a very interesting connection that maybe has a moment in pause in clinical relevance. You can feed a diet of soy and flax to an individual and get a very different effect on their hormone patterns and gene expression based upon the species and type of bacteria and number of bacteria in their gastrointestinal tract. Dr. Hermann Adlercreutz and Dr. Kenneth Setchell have published many papers over the past 20 years in which they have reported different colonic bacteria may have a different effect upon the metabolism and then the generation of secondary metabolites from lignans and from isoflavones. And therefore, a healthy colon with the appropriate fecal flora, facultative anaerobes, and aerobes, all of this together gives rise to a community that helps to convert the substances found in foods and a good diet into the most influential and most effective health promotion agents derived from soy and from flax and other phytoestrogen-containing foods. And therefore, once again, we talk about the body working more as a web than as a series of digital connected parts. Food and food supply interrelates with digestion, interrelates with the fecal flora, interrelates then with the release of secondary metabolites that are picked up by the lumen and transported through the hepatoportal blood to the liver, which are secondarily metabolized to other substances, which then influence signal transduction, cell regulation, and gene expression. It's a very magical connection when you think about it that interrelates the environment that we live, the food that we eat, the flora that live in our gut, which are the largest organ in mass except for the muscles of the body, about 3.5 pounds of bacteria in our digestive tract, and then the relationship of their secondary metabolism to our body's needs, this interesting symbiosis through these class 1 symbiotic bacteria. So the phytoestrogens, again, you say, well, how do you know if you're getting appropriate metabolism and conversion of these into the substances of benefit in cell regulation? And this comes back to why stool analysis has started to become so important and valuable, because unless we look at some of the downstream effects that are related to bacterial action in the gut, which is best analyzed by stool analysis, we may miss such things as appropriate metabolism of these food constituents, the phytoestrogens, into their secondary metabolites. For instance, we know that high beta-glucuronidase levels in the stool are indicative of the overgrowth of denitrifying bacteria and deconjugating bacteria, which are then producing secondary metabolites which are toxic to the colonocytes and alter cell regulation and gene expression and can create an increased colonic risk and a systemic risk due to the release of these toxic substances in the colon. A proper digestion and therapeutic nutrition program, so-called biotherapeutic approach, which reinoculates and renourishes the gut and replenishes appropriate bacteria and uses fructose oligosaccharides and acidophilus and bifidus and L-glutamine and antioxidants and various prebiotic substances like inulin, can in fact influence then the regeneration of appropriate bacteria at the expense of these deconjugating bacteria, and then lower beta-glucuronidase activities and alter, let's say, and improve the whole colonic metabolic environment. So phytoestrogens are certainly a very important part of the story. We know that there is a concentration difference in cell culture work on DNA synthesis in human breast cancer cells. When phytoestrogens are present, it helps to cause proper differentiation of the cells in culture and reduce then their conversion to oncogenic prototypes. This was published in Nutrition and Cancer, Volume 28, page 236. And we know that looking at a case control study of phytoestrogens in breast cancer, individuals who consume these naturally occurring cumestans, isoflavones, and lignans These are women that there is a more significant chemoprotection in these women who consume higher levels of these phytoestrogens, and it's correlated with the excretion of the secondary metabolites of lignans like Equal and introlactone in the urine that are a byproduct of bacterial metabolism of lignans. So again, gut bacteria, diet, breast cancer risk, gene expression, all interrelated, and we can start analyzing this through looking at what comes in the diet, what are the fecal bacteria, and what goes out in the urine and stool. A very, very interesting, obvious advance in the way we look at medicine from the gene expression perspective. We're going to move on and really apply this at a very fascinating level with our Clinician of the Month this month on Side 2. So let's turn to Side 2 of the February issue of Functional Medicine Update.
I know that you've all gotten very used to having the top clinicians in the world who have been our guests at the Clinician of the Month corner of Functional Medicine Update. This month is certainly not going to be any disappointment. We are very privileged and pleased to have Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski, who most of you know has developed a treatment approach towards cancer, which has caught the attention not only of the integrative or complementary medicine, but also of the broader range of science and medicine. As surprising as it may seem, has opened eyes at the federal level, and I think even within our own National Cancer Institute. So it's with great privilege that we have Dr. Brzezinski as our Clinician of the Month, our Researcher of the Month as well. He achieved his medical doctorate degree at the Lublin Poland Medical Academy University in 1967, his PhD in biochemistry in 1968 from the same institution. He was affiliated with the Baylor College of Medicine from 1972 to 77 as an assistant professor of medicine. He has subsequently then been the president of the Brzezinski Research Institute in Houston, Texas. And I think if you want to really get a sense as to the scope and the breadth and the vision of Dr. Brzezinski, you should read the new book that has recently been published this year, The Brzezinski Breakthrough, by Thomas Elias, which is published by W. Key Hayes Publishers in Santa Monica, California. It's a 1997 publication, and I think it's a tremendously eloquent review of the extraordinary contributions that Dr. Brzezinski has made and the politics of some of the things that have happened to him in his career and his vigilance in fighting the good battle to have this information continue to evolve. So with that and the knowledge that Dr. Brzezinski has got over 100 publications to his curriculum vitae and many, many books, many presentations in international well-regarded meetings, I introduce you to Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski. And the first question I guess I should ask is, could you tell us a little bit about what are antineoplastins, Dr. Brzezinski?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on your program. It's a great honor to be able to talk to you today. Antineoplastins are components of body defense system against cancer. According to our theory, there are two defense systems in our body. One of them is immune system, the other one is what we call biochemical defense system, or BDS. Whereas immune system protects us against invasion of microorganisms, then biochemical defense system protects us from occurrence of abnormal cells, such as cancerous cells. The immune system works primarily by recognition and elimination of the invaders. Biochemical defense system works through reprogramming of the cells which developed in improper way. How it does? By using molecular switches, more or less. The chemicals which we name antineoplastins are small peptides, amino acid derivatives, and certain organic acids, and they can regulate the genes which are involved in the process of cancer or the process of manufacturing some other abnormal cells. And they turn off the genes which are stimulating cancer growth, and they stimulate the genes which are inhibiting cancer growth. So that's the basic difference between antineoplastins and components of the immune system.
For many of you who may be unfamiliar with Dr. Brzezinski's antineoplastin work and his theory, and you might think that this is esoteric, I'd like to just quickly quote for you a comment from Dr. Robert Burdick, who is a Seattle, Washington-based oncologist and a faculty member of the University of Washington Medical School, and a person that I actually know from experience up here in the Pacific Northwest. Dr. Burdick, a very well-respected medical oncologist, when asked to evaluate the clinical benefit of antineoplastin therapy in brain cancer, said something, and I quote, It is very rare currently to ever get a complete remission or cure in a patient who has a malignant brain tumor using our standard modalities of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. As a rough estimate, neurosurgeons do well to cure one in every 1,000 brain cancer patients they operate on. Radiation therapy slows the growth of an adult tumor, gaining perhaps 1 month of life, and again may result in a cure in only one in 500 to 1,000 patients, those cures being in the pediatric age group. Similarly, chemotherapy research, despite 30 years of clinical trials, has not resulted in the development of a single drug or drug combination that elicits more than an occasional transient response in primary brain tumors. I am very impressed with the number of complete and partial responses that I have seen here with the Brzezinski method compared with the number of responses that I have seen in my personal experience. The responses here are also far in excess of any prior series of experience published in the medical literature. The response rate here is an astounding 81% with an equally astounding 35% complete remission rate. Such remission rates are far in excess of anything or anyone else has seen since research work on brain tumors began. It is very clear that the responses here are due to anti-neoplastin therapy and are not due to surgery, radiation, or standard chemotherapy, end quote. So if I don't have your attention yet, then you're not listening. Now, with that quote in mind, Dr. Brzezinski, could you tell us how you came about the anti-neoplastin therapy, I mean, in concept theory?
Well, this was more coincidental. As a student, I was working on amino acids in human blood in various disorders, trying to see if changes in amino acid concentration can give us some diagnostic clues. And what I found is that in patients who have cancer, there was a great decrease of certain amino acid derivatives in blood. Some of these cancer patients simply, they have absence of some amino acid derivatives. I isolated these unknown amino acid derivatives, and I found that they were peptides. And then later on, when I characterized them and identified that they can produce inhibition of cancer growth, I call them anti-neoplastins. What was interesting about these compounds is that on one hand, they were producing substantial inhibition of cancer cell growth in the tissue culture. On the other hand, they were not affecting normal cells. They had some high specificity toward cancerous cells, and this was something which was very unusual. And that's why I decided to determine the chemical structure of anti-neoplastins and do whatever is required to bring them to FDA approval, starting with preclinical trials, preclinical studies, and now ending in phase two clinical trials.
I know from my experience working with Dr. Linus Pauling at the Pauling Institute that he and his colleague, Dr. Arthur Robinson, back in the 1960s, were doing amino acid analysis by HPLC of plasma and urine from cancer in normal patients, and they had also observed this interesting difference in the peptide range of the chromatograms. So it seems to me that you really picked up on this and moved it to a new level. Against the dominant theory was at the time, and even maybe existing today, that small molecules cannot have the kind of regulatory effect that the big protein molecules with a lot more structure-function relationship can have, so people have kind of overlooked these small molecules as important regulators.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, at that time, when I was a medical student, everybody was excited by large molecules, and small molecules were neglected as so-called waste products. And now the pendulum is changing. It's swinging in the other direction because now people are excited about small molecules. We know that even such small molecules like nitric oxide may have tremendous effect in the body. So anyway, what we found really are relatively simple chemicals. They may contain few amino acids, or sometimes they contain one amino acid and another prosthetic group. But such structure allows them really to regulate much bigger molecules, like, for instance, regulate the genes. And that's what they do in our body. So in order to effectively control cancer, it's not absolutely necessary to know completely the structure of the genes which are involved in cancer or the proteins which are involved in formation of cancer. It may be sufficient to identify the molecules which are controlling these large molecules, and we may come to the control of cancer.
I know that you have done work on several very, very interesting molecules that I think most chemists would probably have said were secondary waste products and not biologically active molecules, like phenylacetate as a potential precursor to antineoplastins and 3-phenylacetamide and 2,6-piperidinedione. These are smaller nitrogen-containing organic molecules that are normally not considered very biologically active. Do you still see these kinds of molecules as within the range of interesting antineoplastin-like substances?
Well, these are prototype antineoplastins. The simplest antineoplastin so far is phenylacetate. We use phenylacetate and name it antineoplastin AS5 in 1980. Phenylacetate did not give us the greatest anti-cancer activity, but again, it may serve as a model. Since then, there are approximately 200 publications on phenylacetate alone by such prominent researchers like the team from the National Cancer Institute. And we know now that phenylacetate plays important part in regulation of RAS oncogenes. RAS oncogenes is a group of oncogenes which are involved in formation of approximately 40% of all cancers. And we know that phenylacetate is able to turn off the signal which is coming from RAS oncogenes and which is responsible for constant multiplication of malignant cells. We also know that phenylacetate may regulate P53 tumor suppressor gene, which means it's possible that it can unblock the gene which is hypermethylated, and it can increase activity of the gene. This way, it can protect us from multiplication of abnormal or malignant cells. Of course, phenylacetate is the weakest of antineoplastins, and at this moment, we are not using phenylacetate alone in the treatment, but we came up with some additional antineoplastins, which are much more potent, and that's what we use in today's treatment.
I'm looking at two articles that appeared this year in the journal Molecular Medicine Today, one in the April 97 issue and the other in the June 97 issue. One is entitled How Cancer Gene Testing Can Benefit Patients, which is very interesting because they talk about genotyping individuals for their potential risk based on P53, P21, RAS, and BRCA gene types. And then the other is an article entitled P53 as a Target for Anti-Cancer Immunotherapy. And it seems to me that you are helping to make a lot of this genetic research useful because it's not just telling a person about their risk, it's telling us how we might do something about it.
Definitely. And what is really important is that in about 50% of all cancers, we really don't have mutation of tumor suppressor gene as the initial event, but we have a blockage of the gene. And we have blockage of the gene by a relatively simple reaction, which consists of attachment of methyl group, again, a very simple organic group, to the DNA. Recently, a new gene has been discovered, which is called P73, which has a lot of the activity of P53. But it looks like in this particular gene, one copy of the gene is constantly blocked by excessive methylation. And what we found long time ago, that antineoplastins can selectively decrease methylation of these genes, which means they can activate the genes which are dormant, which are inactive in our body. And if we can inactivate, if we can increase activity of the genes, such as P53 or VHL gene, which is responsible for many cases of kidney cancer, then the rest happens automatically. The proteins which are produced by the gene will get rid of cancer, will stop malignant cells from multiplication. So really, what we are using is more like a gene therapy, but I would say poor man gene therapy. We don't need to introduce genes by using special vectors. We are simply unblocking the genes which exist in our body, and these are tumor suppressor genes, or we are interrupting signal transmission along certain oncogene pathways. This is a peaceful way. We don't need to kill malignant cells. We are simply like turning off electricity in the signaling pathway of oncogenes, and we are unblocking tumor suppressor genes. And the rest will happen automatically because these malignant cells, which do not multiply anymore, they will be forced to die through apoptosis or programmed cell death.
I was very impressed by, many of your papers, which I've had a chance and privilege to read, but one that you published back in 1986 on altered methylation complex isozymes as selective targets for your antineoplastins. I think that that ties together this whole interesting story that's just starting to emerge that interrelates methyl groups, promiscuous methylation or undermethylation, and in relationship to carcinogenesis and uncovering oncogenes. So it seems like you have a very interesting point of convergence between the methylation theory and antineoplastin theory.
Well, it's extremely interesting. Unfortunately, initially when we began to work on this back in the late 70s, very few people realize what it is about, okay? And now more and more researchers are looking upon this as extremely exciting subject to study. Because if we realize that only a small percentage of our genes are active at any time, then most of the genes are blocked. And these genes are usually blocked by methylation. So if we understand the process and if we learn how to unblock some of these genes in our body, then we may have a really wonderful way to control various disorders. For instance, there have been studies done by the group from Johns Hopkins Medical School on anemias, such as, for instance, sickle cell anemia or thalassemia. They found that by using phenylacetate, they can unblock the gene of hemoglobin F in adult patients. Of course, we know that hemoglobin F is blocked soon after the birth, but it's blocked through methylation. And again, if we know how to unblock this, then we can increase production of hemoglobin F in adult patients. And if the percentage of hemoglobin F in patients who has anemia, such as sickle cell anemia or thalassemia, will reach over 15%, then the symptoms of the anemia will disappear, which is extremely important. Again, we are talking about a variety of neurological disorders when the genes are blocked. For instance, neurofibromatosis is such a common disorder. We know that one individual out of 4,000 may have blockage or mutation of neurofibromatosis 1 gene. And again, in many of these patients, we are dealing not with mutation of the gene, but what is called genomic imprinting, blockage of the gene through methylation. If we know how to decrease methylation of the gene, then perhaps we can find also the treatment for the disease, which is normally incurable. So this may open a great possibilities in various fields, not only in cancers, but in neurological disorders, in anemias, also in autoimmune diseases. But of course, it looks like we barely scratched the surface. It will take years, it will take involvement of many other researchers to study exactly how this approach works in various illnesses and also to develop more effective antineoplastins.
It's very exciting for me in that in 1949, Pauling and Itano published what I consider a landmark paper in Science Magazine entitled Sickle Cell Anemia, a Molecular Disease, in which they went through and discussed the point gene mutation and the heavy chain of the globin protein and hemoglobin that results in sickle cell characteristic. And it was not until then, as you pointed out, the 90s, in which the manipulation of the gene expression to give the fetal hemoglobin using phenylacetate or hydroxyurea or butyrate was discovered at some 40 or 50 years later. So it seems like your field is coming of age now, and your prescience in the field certainly must give you great pride to watch it opening up in this way.
Well, yes, like it's always, if you see something in advance, then unfortunately many of your peers don't want to understand it, or they simply don't understand it, and simply have to survive for many years until these people will understand what you are talking about. So it looks like we are coming to the time when more and more physicians are understanding what we are talking about, and they are interested in this. So I believe that with such changes, it's just a matter of time when we'll be able to help many more people who are suffering from incurable diseases.
Well, with that in mind, can we go on and talk a little bit about the evolution of how you have evolved the approach and treatment using the antineoplastin concept?
Well, we selected the most difficult type of malignancies for this treatment because we wanted to prove that when the treatment works, there is no other way to explain why the tumor disappeared, just only because we use the treatment. And that's why we selected the type of malignancies which normally do not respond to any type of chemotherapy, such as primary brain tumors. We used two types of methods to deliver antineoplastins. When we are dealing with malignant brain tumor, we usually use intravenous infusions, which are delivered through a special computerized pump and also through subclavian vein catheter. This is a treatment which is done outpatient. The patient carries the pump, and the pump delivers medicines every day intravenously. Currently, we are conducting 72 different phase 2 clinical trials, which are approved by the FDA. And most of these clinical trials, well, approximately 24 of these clinical trials, concern treatment of various types of brain tumors. Then, in the remaining clinical trials, we are treating a great variety of cancers. Like, for instance, we have 10 clinical trials for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We have a number of different clinical trials for lung cancer, for gastrointestinal tumors, etc. So we are beginning to see how the treatment works in these different categories. And since we put most emphasis on malignant brain tumors, then in this category we see currently the results of the treatment. We already have three clinical trials in this area, which already prove statistically that antineoplastins have a therapeutic effect against these tumors. And in these categories, we have a number of cases of patients who obtain either complete disappearance of the tumor or more than 30% decrease of the size of the tumor. We already have patients who are over 5 years since they used our treatment, and they don't have any tumor recurrence, and they are off treatment. And these are the patients who have tough cancers, tough malignancies to treat, such as glioblastoma multiforme or anaplastic astrocytoma. So I believe you already proved the point that at least with some patients, we can eliminate such terrible malignant brain tumors completely. Another exciting area is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Again, in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's easier to produce remission, but it's not so easy to cure lymphoma, especially if we are talking about low-grade lymphomas. And in this category, we also have a number of responses. Usually, we are talking about patients who tried everything, who failed, for instance, on bone marrow transplantation. And many of these patients responded to treatment with antineoplastins. And again, a number of these patients are now free from the disease and free from the treatment for over 5 years. In the other areas, we are gradually developing statistical results. We see some exciting responses in some patients who have esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, kidney cancer, certain forms of lung cancer, malignant mesothelioma. But it will still take some time to accumulate sufficient number of cases and come up with statistical results. What is important about the treatment is that we seldom see side effects. In most cases, the treatment is easy to administer. It can be done outpatient, and it does not require a lot of attention from the treating physician. Usually, after we stabilize patients at certain dosages, we can see patients once every 1 to 2 months. So I believe that this will be a blessing for both patients and doctors, because it can make the field of oncology exciting again, because you see now patients who are responding well to the treatment and who do not suffer from terrible side effects.
Has anyone as of yet been able to identify a receptor site for any of these peptide-like antineoplastin molecules and how it influences the apoptotic process, or is that still a field of investigation?
No, as a matter of fact, some of these mechanisms have been elucidated in great details. And basically, if we are talking about RAS oncogene, there's a crucial reaction which is inhibited by antineoplastins AS5, AS2, and AS2-1. And this is the reaction of decarboxylation. It's one of the steps which leads to farnesylation of P21 protein, which is a product of RAS oncogene. In order to produce farnesyl residue, which should be attached to this P21 RAS protein, we need to decarboxylate we need to decarboxylate pyrophosphomevalonate. And then from this reaction, we have a fragment which is called isopentanyl pyrophosphate, which is polymerizing and forming farnesyl residue. Farnesyl residue is necessary to produce attachment of P21 protein to the cell membrane. If the protein is not attached, then the signal will not be transmitted. And that's what we are accomplishing. We are interrupting signal transmission by inhibition of one of the reactions which is instrumental in this process. If we are talking about P53 tumor suppressor gene, we know that antineoplastin AS2-1 and AS5 is activating a gene which is called WAF1. And this is one of the genes which is normally activated by P53 protein. And again, once this gene is activating, it's responsible for producing another P21 protein. This time it's not a RAF protein, but a product of WAF gene. And this protein takes part in inhibition of methylation of promoter sequences of important genes, and among other things, the genes which are tumor suppressor genes. All of this is evolving in front of our eyes, whereas the first reaction, which is interrupting signal transmission in RAF protein, was elucidated a few years ago by the group of researchers in Spain. And then this newest reaction, in which product of WAF oncogene is involved, was published in Science magazine only about a month ago. So practically every month we see some new fragments to the puzzle, and this is greatly expanding our knowledge. Of course, I could speak longer about these items and give you more details, but I think the time is too short and I don't want to drown you in great details how antineoplastin works.
Well, I think you've done a very beautiful job of summarizing an extraordinary amount of work and sophistication. It's interesting to me that there is a potential connection in what you've just described between the farnesylation reactions and the interruption of isopentenyl pyrophosphate polymerization due to statin drugs, and how that may relate to the cholesterol-lowering effects of statins, but also relate to potential cancer effects that have been seen in animals that have been treated with statin drugs. So you may be on some other areas of cardiology here as well, it seems.
No doubt about it. Of course, many patients who have cancer, they have hypercholesterolemia, and no wonder, because obviously they have increased activity of RAS oncogene, and they produce more of isopentenyl pyrophosphate residues, which, again, after many steps, after about 30-plus steps, will lead to manufacturing of biosynthesis of cholesterol. But there's also another important connection through P53 gene, and this concerns one of the big problem in cardiology, which is restenosis. During the restenosis, we have activation of latent CMV virus. And this virus is responsible for the synthesis of protein, which is called IE84. Again, this protein reacts with P53 protein and inactivates this. And it's causing uncontrolled proliferation of myoblasts in the arterial wall. And again, it's possible to control this process by using antineoplastin, because then we can increase, of course, activity of P53 gene. That's only one of the examples, and I am glad to see that the research in this area is expanding. Many more researchers are now working on these various issues than a year ago. Of course, we have rather small research institute, and we are not able to do a lot of these things, but fortunately, there are many researchers all over the world who are joining the club.
Yes, that's obvious, and I think your pioneering work is certainly seeded a field that is just virtually exploding. In fact, when I go back and look at the what I would call naysayer review in the JAMA by Saul Green, which I think has been overly cited by other investigators who don't understand what this whole antineoplastin concept is about, and Saul Green's review was founded on what appears to me to be a lack of really understanding or depth of understanding, or maybe a set of a priori assumptions that were built into the article before he even wrote it. The article is entitled Antineoplastins and Unproven Cancer Therapy. It appeared in Journal Volume 267 in 1992 of the JAMA. I was very intrigued to see the letters to the editor that have followed that from some what might be considered very neutral academic types who took great exception to Dr. Green's treatise and said obviously he had some flaws in the way he evaluated the research, and it didn't seem like he really knew what he was talking about. And I'm sure you've had to deal with that issue, but it seems to be blowing over as new scientists get in the field.
Well, it was an unfair article, and what we learned, it was written for sole purpose to somehow persuade physicians do not send patients for the treatment with angioplasms. But again, exactly 2 years after this article occurred, there was another article, editorial in JAMA, written by Dr. Broder. Of course, Dr. Broder at the time was director of the National Cancer Institute. And in this particular article, Dr. Broder described the study on phenylacetate as the greatest event in oncology within the last 10 years. So it looks like the effect of Saul Green article was short-lived. Now we see many, many researchers who are proving the point that the approach is right, our approach is right.
Let me ask just one last question. I apologize for keeping you so long, but this has been obviously a very fascinating discussion. And my last question is, you've raised some general thoughts about gene expression and the modulation of gene expression with small molecules. And I would like to give you a moment just to describe how you think this might relate to a general model towards disease and age-related dysfunction and where that might take us in medicine in the future.
Well, I believe that within the last 100 years, we were concentrating on getting rid of microbial infections, more or less, and of course, we have good success in this area. So now, of course, we are entering a new era of information processing, and we are encountering the illnesses which are information processing disorders. And here we have cancer, here we have autoimmune illnesses, certain neurological disorders, and certain disorders caused by slow viruses. And in most of these, we have just disturbance of information processing. And this requires completely different approach. It requires the approach which also deals with information. Of course, information deals with the processing of signals, and what we need to use, we need to practically introduce some switches which can turn off bad signals and turn on good signals, and then the rest will happen by itself. And of course, if we are talking about the possibility of awakening certain genes which are dormant in our body, then the future seems to be enormous, because of course, if we know how to unblock certain genes, then we can stimulate regeneration of the organs in the adult organism. And of course, there were some papers already on this subject. Then perhaps if we unblock the genes which are responsible for producing certain growth factors like neurotrophins, then perhaps we can increase longevity of the neurons in our brain. And perhaps we can come up with regeneration of the neurons. We know that even in such complex organisms like birds, it's possible to trigger regeneration of the neurons in brain in the adult organism. And as a matter of fact, some birds are doing this every year. When, for instance, they have a singing period, then they have occurrence of new set of neurons in certain part of the brain. And apparently, this consists of unblocking of the genes which are necessary in this process. Of course, this needs to be done in caution, because if it is not done correctly, it could lead to disaster. But I believe finding the clue how to regulate important genes for us can protect us from a number of illnesses, can, of course, provide us effective treatment for a variety of disorders, and perhaps it can even increase our lifespan. So this is extremely exciting future, and it calls for cooperation of researchers in many fields.
Dr. Brzezinski, we can't thank you enough, and I know there will be many questions that people will have that they'll want to follow up on. I recommend once again the book, The Brzezinski Breakthrough, which I gave the citation to earlier, and we will put that on the summary cards at the end of this month's tape. Where can people contact you if they want to either refer patients or develop a relationship with your research clinic?
Well, please give us a call. The number is 281 area code 597 0111, 281-597-0111. We are located in Houston, 12,000 Richmond Avenue. and the zip code is 77082. We'd be glad to send you a number of reprints or publication lists, and if you are interested in the treatment and accrual to clinical trials, then we have a team of doctors who are promptly reviewing information to find out if the patient is a candidate for clinical trials. So please give us a call, and we'd be glad to give you more information.
We'll make sure that those numbers get included again on the summary cards for those people that may be listening in their car and can't write it down. Please don't drive off the road. You'll find it on your summary cards. And once again, Dr. Brzezinski, thank you so much. And we hope we'll be able to check in with you in the future and find out the progress of this very exciting development that you're pioneering.
Thank you very much, and it's my pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
I hope that you found the interview with Dr. Brzezinski to be as fascinating as I did and opened your mind to this whole concept of small molecules as well as large molecules regulating cellular expression, gene expression, and the phenotype of cells, and opening up a door to how we might see medicine changing in the next decades ahead related to modifying gene expression by administration of substances that wake up certain gene messages and put to sleep others. I was talking at the close of Side 1 of this month's Functional Medicine Update about breast cancer specifically as an example of how we're learning how environmental and nutritional modulators and drug modulators influence gene expression and breast cancer risk. And I was closing my discussion talking about phytoestrogens, the isoflavones, comestins, and lignans. Well, there's a very interesting commentary in The Lancet that goes back in light of what Dr. Brzezinski was talking about, because I want you to recall these are small molecules. These have low molecular weight. They're not proteinaceous molecules, these isoflavones and these comestins and lignans. They're molecules that generally organic chemists work with rather than polypeptide or nucleic acid molecules that biological chemists or molecular biologists work with. So what we're starting to see is a very interesting marriage between the macromolecular world of the internal cellular milieu and a smaller molecular world and how these substances all interrelate in setting up cell messages and signal transduction and gene expression. So let me go back to the phytoestrogens in breast cancer just for a moment and talk about what the editorial by Setchell, Barnes, and Messina brought to our attention. This phytoestrogen and breast cancer hypothesis stems in part from the low breast cancer mortality rates in Asian countries where soy foods, which are high in isoflavones, are commonly consumed. And I think you all recognize that the isoflavones, genistein and diazine, do exert some very interesting biological functions. Genistein influences enzymes involved in single transduction that regulate cell growth and replication. There are many papers of this within the last few years. Genistein also augments signaling mechanisms mediated by transforming growth factor beta and inhibits the progression of cells through their G1S phase. Again, many papers on this. Phytoestrogens have antioxidant properties, and we recognize, as I mentioned earlier, that they increase the upregulation of gene expression of phase 2 detoxifying enzymes. The findings then that were described at the end of Side 1 of Functional Medicine Update on the case control study of phytoestrogens in breast cancer, in which was found to be a substantial reduction in breast cancer risk among women with high intake as measured by excretion of phytoestrogens, particularly the isoflavones, genistein and diazine, and the lignin interolactone. These particular observations are obviously encouraging. There are also 5 control studies since 1991 that examine the relationship between soy intake and breast cancer risk. 3 of those studies found a significantly reduced risk for premenopausal breast cancer, but only one, which was conducted in the United States, for postmenopausal breast cancer. In that study, however, protective effects for both premenopausal and postmenopausal women were observed primarily in Asian immigrants, not in U.S.-born Asians, which may indicate that there are other factors ongoing related to gene expression factors or other environmental factors. In addition to the case control studies, a cohort study in the United States reported thus far only in abstract form found a non-significant decreased breast cancer risk associated with tofu intake. So the story is not completely clear, and I don't think we should jump to the conclusion that we will have no breast cancer as long as everyone eats their soy products. I think that would be an exaggeration. And I think for the reasons that you can see, as we've discussed this month, there are complex genetic polymorphisms, and there are multiple factors that influence those genes, only some of which may be related to soy or isoflavone phytoestrogen intake. We know about fiber certainly having observation of lowered risk with breast cancer. Many studies the last few years that have correlated increased fiber with reduced breast cancer incidence. We also recognize that there are maybe other protective effects exerted by plant precursors other than the phytoestrogens that would give an additive effect in chemoprotection against breast cancer in women with specific genotypes. So I don't want you to take away from this discussion that the panacea is soy or phytoestrogens or flaxseed. It's a combination of agents which modulate specific gene uniquenesses to the expression of phenotype that ultimately will alert us to how to design the appropriate program for a specific individual, a specific woman. Right now, the tools that we're using are still in the early stages. We don't have all the gene markers or all the ability to analyze all the characteristics that we might ultimately like to have. But we can tie together specific family history factors from a good family history analysis, personal risk factors, the history of fibrocystic disease, and dietary persuasions and factors, and gut microbial ecology as measured through stool analysis, and other factors related to antioxidant defense mechanisms, all of which then might start to give a web of understanding of that woman's risk to breast cancer and how diet can be utilized in a tailored way to modify the expression of risk. Emerging evidence from animal studies suggests that short-term exposure to dietary isoflavones neonatally or pre-pubertally decreases carcinogen-induced breast cancer by increasing the proportion of differentiated cells in the mammary gland. These studies support a concept derived from other epidemiological investigations that the protective effect of the southeastern diet may occur early in life, and therefore the earlier we can introduce these desirable phytonutrients, the better off it would appear. However, giving these products to infants may not be desirable. I think you recall we discussed an article from Lancet in which it was found that infant formulas that are very high in isoflavones, that if they're soy-based infant formulas, may expose the infant to too high a level of these hormone-like substances and actually modify hormone endocrine development. So probably introducing soy or isoflavone lignin-containing foods when the child starts to eat solid foods is more desirable than giving it in infant formulas. Of much potential significance is the finding that phytoestrogens may be involved as a new player in estrogen action at the estrogen receptor beta, which is distinct from the classical estrogen receptor. Genistein shows a much greater affinity as a ligand for the estrogen beta receptor than the alpha receptor, suggesting that it may exert actions via a different receptor pathway than estrogen itself. Interestingly, this new receptor shows a different anatomical distribution from the alpha receptor, being expressed more predominantly in tissues such as the brain, prostate, and urinary tract. And so there is accumulating evidence, obviously, that isoflavones and lignans can exert beneficial effects related to several chronic diseases, not just breast cancer, but also osteoporosis and heart disease, and perhaps to hormone-independent cancers. One, however, does need to be some concerned, if it's an estrogen-dependent cancer, about giving too high levels of soy in the diet, because you could modulate adversely those estrogen-dependent receptor sites, and therefore there's still question as to whether in an estrogen-positive receptor-type breast cancer, soy is beneficial or deleterious. I personally would err on the side of conservancy at this point and not administer high soy-based diets to women who have estrogen-positive receptor breast cancer. So certainly this soy story, the isoflavone story, the lignin story, the cumestin story, the phytoestrogen story is one very exciting example of how nutrient modulation of gene expression can play a role in chemoprotection and maybe even in cancer therapy. Dr. Stephen Austin, in a very recent paper in Alternative Medicine Review, Volume 2, page 4, in 1997, discusses this recent progress in the treatment and secondary prevention of breast cancer with nutritional gene-modulating agents. And he talks about not only the isoflavones and the lignans, but also things like coenzyme Q10 as an agent that has been shown, at least in provisional studies, to favorably influence treatment in breast cancer women. And I think that there are a number of papers that he cites using up to 390 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 daily, which have demonstrated positive benefit. Again, this has a lot to do with the oxidative stress elements and the gene response and signal transduction mechanisms that we've been describing earlier. He also talks about melatonin and the increasing evidence that it may be helpful for the management of certain types of breast cancer and doses that are up to 10 milligrams a day, very high doses relative to the doses we normally think for normalizing sleep, have been used in some preliminary studies. So again, melatonin, a small molecule, nitrogen-containing byproduct of the metabolism of tryptophan, appears as if it has some positive effect in breast carcinoma. Vitamin D, he cites also as having influence in a variety of tumors, including breast cancer, due to its immunological activating effects, beyond that of its calcium bone stimulating effects. And of course, we've talked already about selenium and vitamin E and the relationships they have to normalizing function. So I think in close this month, we can say something I think that might herald a first stage of a new era in functional medicine update and in medicine in general, and that is the opening of the door to unique identification of gene polymorphisms and how to regulate gene expression utilizing specific nutrition, diet, and lifestyle and environment interventions so as to express the appropriate phenotype, and that there are small molecules that are floating around as signal substances that if we can adjust the molecular milieu, as Dr. Pauling talked about in his molecular medicine concept and Dr. Williams talked about in his biochemical individuality concept, that we not only can prevent but treat potential disorders that are related to altered signal transduction. I thank Dr. Brzezinski for opening this model to us, and I look forward to seeing you at the 5th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, where we'll have several days to really deal with this issue in much greater detail and get down to some of the clinical applications. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you in March.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.